embedded itself deep within the plant's thick trunk. Immediately the roots about his feet released their grip and sank into the earth, and the main portion of the tree shuddered violently, limbs thrashing the air and showering needles in all directions. A moment later, it drooped slowly to the earth. With a final spasm, it lay motionless. Still heavily drugged from the needles, Minion felt the strong hands of his rescuer grip his shoulders roughly and force him into a prone position, while a broad hunting knife severed the few remaining strands binding his feet. The figure before him was a powerfully built dwarf, dressed in the green and brown woodsman's clothing worn by most of that race. He was tall for a dwarf, a little over 5 feet, and carried a small arsenal of weapons bound about his broad waist. He looked down at the drugged Minion and shook his head dubiously.
"You must be a stranger to do a dumb thing like that," he reprimanded the other in his deep bass voice. "Nobody with any sense plays around with the sirens."
"I'm from Lee. To the west," Minion managed to gasp out, his voice thick and strange to his own ears.
"A Highlander. I might have known."
The dwarf laughed heartily to himself.
"You'd have to be, I suppose. Well, don't worry. You'll be fine in a few days. That drug won't kill you if we get it treated, but you'll be out for a while."
He laughed again and turned to retrieve his mace. Minion, with his final ounce of strength, grasped him by the tunic.
"I must reach the Anar. Cullhaven," he gasped sharply. "Take me to Balinor."
The dwarf looked back at him sharply, but Minion had lapsed into unconsciousness. Muttering to himself, the dwarf picked up his own weapons and those of the fallen Highlander. Then, with surprising strength, he heaved the limp form of Minion over his broad shoulders, testing the load for balance. Satisfied at last that all was in place, he began trudging steadily, muttering all the while, moving toward the forests of the Anar. Chapter 8 Flick Ohmsford sat quietly on a long stone bench in one of the upper levels of the lavishly beautiful Mead Gardens in the dwarf community known as Cullhaven. He had a perfect view of the amazing gardens stretching down the rocky hillside in systematic levels that tapered off about the edges in carefully laid pieces of cut stone, reminiscent of a long waterfall flowing down a gentle slope. The creation of the gardens on this once barren hillside was a truly marvelous accomplishment. Special soils had been hauled from more fertile regions to be placed on the garden site, enabling thousands of beautiful flowers and plants to flourish year-round in the mild climate of the lower Anar. The color was indescribable. To compare the myriad hues of the flowers to the colors of the rainbow would have been a great injustice. Flick attempted briefly to count the various shades, a task he soon found to be impossible. He gave up quickly and turned his attention to the large clearing at the foot of the gardens, where members of the dwarf community were passing on their way to or from whatever work they were engaged in. They were a curious people, it seemed to Flick, so dedicated to hard work and a well-guarded order of life. Everything they did was always carefully planned in advance, meticulously thought out to a point where even the cautious Flick was nettled by the time spent in preparation. But the people were friendly and eager to be of service, a kindness not lost on either of the visiting Veilmen, who felt more than a bit out of place in this strange land. They had been in Cullhaven for 2 days now, and still they had not been able to learn what had happened to them, why they were there, or how long their stay would be. Balinor had told them nothing, advising them that he knew very little himself, and that all would be revealed in due time, a comment Flick found to be not only melodramatic but aggravating. There was no sign of Alanon, no word of his whereabouts. Worst of all, there was no news of the absent Minion, and the brothers had been forbidden to leave the safety of the dwarf village for any reason. Flick glanced to the floor of the gardens again to see if his personal bodyguard was still there, and quickly spied him off to one side, his tireless gaze fixed on the Veilman. Shay had been infuriated by this treatment, but Balinor was quick to point out that someone should be with them at all times in case of an attempt on their lives by one of the roving Northland creatures. Flick had acquiesced readily, remembering all too well the close calls he had already had with the Skullbearers. He put aside his idle thoughts at the approach of Shay on the winding garden path. "Anything?" Flick asked anxiously as the other reached his side and sat down quietly next to him. "Not one word," came the short reply. Shay felt vaguely exhausted all over again, even though he had had 2 days to recover from the strange odyssey that had brought them from their home in Shady Vale to the forests of Anar. Their treatment had been decent, if sometimes a bit overdone, and the people seemed genuinely concerned for their welfare. But there had been no word given out as to what was to happen next. Everyone, including Balinor, seemed to be waiting for something, perhaps the arrival of the long-absent Alanon. Balinor had been unable to explain to them how they had reached the Anar. Responding to a mysterious flashing light, he had found them lying on a low riverbank just outside of Cullhaven 2 days ago, and had brought them to the village. He knew nothing of the old man, nor of how they had traveled that long distance upstream. When Shay mentioned the legends concerning a king of the Silver River, Balinor shrugged and nonchalantly agreed that anything was possible. "No news of Menyn?" Flick asked hesitantly. "Only that the dwarfs are still out looking for him. And it may take some time," Shay answered quietly. "I don't know what to do next." Flick inwardly conceded that this last admission had proved to be the story of the entire outing. He glanced downward to the foot of the Mead Gardens, where a small cluster of heavily armed dwarfs were congregating around the commanding figure of Balinor, who had suddenly appeared from the woods beyond. Even from their vantage point atop the gardens, the Veilmen could tell that he still wore the chainmail beneath the long hunting cloak they had come to recognize so well. He spoke earnestly with the dwarfs for a few minutes, his face lined in thought. Shay and Flick knew very little about the Prince of Callahorn, but the people of Cullhaven seemed to have the highest regard for him. Menyn, too, had spoken well of Balinor. His homeland was the northernmost kingdom of the sprawling Southland. Commonly referred to as the Borderlands, it served as a buffer zone fronting the southern boundaries of the Northland. The citizens of Callahorn were predominantly men, but unlike the majority of the people of their race, they mingled freely with the other races and did not pursue a policy of isolationism. The highly regarded Border Legion was quartered in that distant country, a professional army commanded by Rule Buckhanna, King of Callahorn and the father of Balinor. Historically, the entire Southland had relied on Callahorn and the Legion to blunt the initial thrust of an invading army, giving the rest of the land a chance to prepare for battle. In the 500 years since its formation, the Border Legion had never been defeated. Balinor had begun a slow ascent to the stone bench where the Veilmen sat patiently waiting. He smiled a greeting as he came up to them, aware of the discomfort they felt in not knowing what was to happen to them, and of the anxiety they were experiencing for the safety of their missing friend. He sat down next to them, and was silent for a few minutes before speaking. "I know how difficult this must be for you," he began patiently. "I have every available dwarf warrior out looking for your lost friend. If anyone can find him in this region, they will, and they won't give up. I promise you." The brothers nodded their understanding of Balinor's efforts to help them in any way possible. "This is a very dangerous time for these people, though I suppose Alanon did not speak of it. They are facing the threat of an invasion through the upper Anar by gnomes. There have already been skirmishes all along the border and signs of a huge army massing somewhere above the Strelaheim Plains. You may have guessed that all of this is tied in with the Warlock Lord.
Does this mean that the Southland is in danger too? Asked an anxious Flick.
Undoubtedly. Balinor nodded. That's one reason why I'm here. To arrange a coordinated defensive strategy with the Dwarf Nation in case of an all-out assault.
But where is Alanon then? Asked Shay quickly. Is he going to get here soon enough to help us? What has the Sword of Shannara got to do with all this?
Balinor looked at the puzzled faces and shook his head slowly. I must honestly confess that I cannot give you the answers to any of those questions. Alanon is a very mysterious figure, but a wise man who has been a dependable ally whenever we have needed him in the past. When I saw him last, several weeks before I spoke to you in Shady Vale, we set a date to meet in the Anar. He is already 3 days overdue. He paused in quiet speculation, looking down at the gardens and beyond to the great trees of the Anar forests, listening to the sounds of the woods and the low voices of the dwarfs moving about in the clearing below. Then abruptly a shout went up from a cluster of dwarfs at the foot of the gardens, joined almost immediately by the shouts and cries of others mingled in with a huge clamor swelling from the woods beyond the village of Cullhaven. The men on the stone bench rose uncertainly, looking quickly about for some sign of danger. Balinor's strong hand came to rest on the pommel of his broadsword, strapped tightly at his side beneath the hunting cloak. A moment later, one of the dwarfs below came rushing up the path, shouting wildly as he ran.
"They found him! They found him!"
he yelled excitedly, almost stumbling in his haste to reach them. Shay and Flick exchanged startled looks. The runner came to a breathless stop before them, and Balinor gripped his shoulder excitedly. "Have they found Minyan Lee?" he demanded quickly. The dwarf nodded happily, his short, stocky frame heaving with the exertion of the dash to reach them with the good news. Without a word, Balinor bounded down the path toward the shouting, Shay and Flick behind him. They reached the clearing below in a matter of seconds and ran along the main path through the woods leading to the village of Cullhaven, several hundred yards beyond. Ahead of them, they could hear the excited shouting of the dwarf population congratulating whomever it was who had found the lost Highlander. They reached the village, and pushing through the throngs of dwarfs blocking the way, made straight for the center of all the excitement. A ring of guards parted to let them into a small courtyard formed by buildings on the right and left and a high stone wall in the rear. On a long wooden table lay the motionless body of Minyan Lee, his face pale and seemingly lifeless. A team of dwarf doctors bent dutifully over the inert form, apparently treating him for some injury. Shay gave a sharp cry and tried to rush forward, but Balinor's strong arm held him back as the warrior called out to one of the nearby dwarfs.
"Pan, what's happened here?"
The solid-looking dwarf, dressed in armor and apparently one of the returning search party, hastened to their side.
"He'll be all right after he's treated. He was found entangled in one of the sirens out in the middle of the Battle Mound lowlands below the Silver River. Our search party didn't find him. It was Hendel, returning from the cities south of Anar."
Balinor nodded and looked about for some sign of the rescuer.
"He left for the assembly hall to make his report," the dwarf responded to the unasked question.
Motioning the two Vale men to follow him, Balinor made his way out of the courtyard through the crowd and across the main street to the large assembly hall. Inside were the offices of the governing officials of the village and the assembly room, in which they found the dwarf Hendel sitting on one of the long benches, eating ravenously while a scribe took down his report. Hendel looked up as they approached, glanced curiously at the Vale men, and nodded briefly to Balinor, continuing to devour his meal without interruption. Balinor dismissed the scribe, and the three men sat down across from the disinterested dwarf, who appeared both exhausted and starved.
"What an idiot! tackling one of those sirens with a sword, he muttered. Got spunk, though. How is he?
He'll be fine after he's treated, replied Balinor, grinning reassuringly at the uneasy Veilmen. How did you find him?
Heard him yelling.
The other continued to eat without pausing.
I had to carry him almost 7 miles before I ran into Pan and the search party along the Silver River.
He paused and looked again at the two Veilmen, who were listening intently. The dwarf appraised them curiously and looked back at Balinor, eyebrows raised. Friends of the Highlander, and of Alanon, responded the borderman, cocking his head meaningfully. Hendel merely nodded to them curtly.
I'd never have known who he was if he hadn't mentioned your name, Hendel informed them shortly, indicating the tall borderman. It might help matters if now and then someone would tell me what was going on. Before it happened, not after.
He declined to comment further, and an amused Balinor smiled over to the puzzled brothers, shrugging slightly to indicate the dwarf was irascible by nature. Shay and Flick were a bit uncertain about the fellow's temperament and had purposely kept silent while the other two conversed, though both Veilmen were eager to hear the full story behind Menyon's rescue. "What's your report on Stern and Wayford?" Balinor asked finally, referring to the large Southland cities immediately south and west of the Anar. Hendel ceased eating and laughed abruptly.
The officials of those two fine communities will consider the matter and send along a report. Typical bungling officials, elected by the disinterested people to juggle the ball until it can be passed on to some other fool. I could tell 5 minutes after I opened my mouth that they thought I was crazy. They don't see the danger until the sword is at their own throats. Then they scream for assistance from those of us who knew it all along.
He paused and resumed his meal, obviously disgusted with the whole subject.
I should have expected that, I suppose.
Balinor sounded worried. How can we convince them of the danger? There hasn't been a war in so many years that no one wants to believe it could happen now.
That's not the real problem, as you well know, interjected the irate Hendel. They simply don't feel they should be involved in the matter. After all, the frontiers are protected by dwarfs, not to mention the cities of Calahorn and the Border Legion. We've been doing it up to now. Why can't we keep doing it?
Those poor fools. He trailed off slowly, finished with his statement and his meal, feeling tired from the long trip home. He had been on the road for almost 3 weeks, traveling to the cities of the Southland, and it all seemed to have been for nothing. He felt keenly discouraged.
I don't understand what's happened, Shay announced quietly.
Well, that's two of us, Hendel replied sullenly. I'm going to bed for about 2 weeks. See you then.
He stood up abruptly and walked out of the assembly room without even a short farewell, his broad shoulders stooped wearily. The three men watched him go without speaking, their eyes fixed on his departing silhouette until it was lost from sight. Then Shay turned questioningly to Balinor. It's the age-old tale of complacency, Shay. The tall warrior sighed deeply and stretched as he rose. We may be standing on the brink of the greatest war in 1,000 years, but no one wants to accept the fact. Everyone gets in the same rut. Let a few take care of the gates to the city while the rest forget and go back to their homes. It becomes a habit, depending on a few to protect the rest. And then one day, the few are not enough. The enemy is within the city, right through the open gates.
Is there really going to be a war? Flick asked, almost fearfully.
That is the question, exactly, Balinor responded slowly.
The only man who can give us the answer is absent, and overdue. In the excitement of finding Minyan alive and well, the Vale men had temporarily forgotten Alanon, the man who was the reason for their being in the Anar in the first place. The by-now familiar questions again flashed through their minds with new persistency, but the Vale men had learned to live with them over the past few weeks, and all doubts were reluctantly shoved aside once more. Balinor caught their attention as he moved toward the open door, and they quickly followed. "You mustn't mind Hendel, you know," he reassured them as they walked. "He's gruff like that with everyone, but he's one of the finest friends you could ask for. He has fought and outwitted the gnomes along the Upper Anar for years, protecting his people and the complacent citizens of the Southland who so quickly forget the crucial role the dwarfs play as guardians of these borders. The gnomes would like to get their hands on him, I can tell you." Shay and Flick said nothing, ashamed of the fact that the people of their own race could be so selfish, yet realizing that they too had been ignorant of the situation in the Anar before hearing of it from Balinor. They were bothered by the thought of renewed hostilities between the races, recalling their history lessons on the old race wars and the terrible hatred of those bitter years. The possibility of a third war of the races was chilling. "Why don't you two go on back to the gardens?" advised the Prince of Callahorn. "I'll have a message sent as soon as I hear of any change in Minyan's condition." The brothers reluctantly agreed, knowing they had no other choice in the matter anyway. Before turning in that night, they stopped by the room where Minyan was being kept, only to be told by the dwarf sentry that their friend was asleep and should not be disturbed. But by the following afternoon, the Highlander was awake and being visited by the anxious Vale men. Even Flick was grudgingly relieved to see the other alive and well, though he solemnly intoned that he had correctly predicted their misfortune many days in advance when they first decided to journey through the Black Oaks. Minyan and Shay both laughed at Flick's eternal pessimism, but did not argue the point. Shay explained how Minyan had been brought to Cullhaven by the dwarf Hendel, and then went on to relate the mysterious way in which he and Flick had been found near the Silver River. Minyan was as mystified as they over their strange journey, and could offer no logical explanation. Shay carefully refrained from mentioning the legend of a king of the Silver River, knowing full well what the Highlander's response would be to any speculation that involved an old folktale. That same day, in the early hours of the evening, word reached them that Alanon had returned. Shay and Flick were about to leave their rooms to visit Minyan when they heard the excited shouts of dwarves rushing past their open windows toward the assembly hall where some sort of meeting was about to begin. The anxious Vale men had not taken two steps beyond their doorway when they were surrounded by a team of four dwarf guards and hustled quickly through the pushing crowds, past the open doors of the large assembly into a small adjoining room, where they were told to remain. The dwarfs closed the door wordlessly as they exited, slid the lock bolts into place, and assumed positions immediately outside. The room was brightly lit and furnished with several long tables and benches, at which the bewildered Vale men silently seated themselves. The windows to the room were closed, and even without checking, Shay knew they would be barred like the door. From the assembly hall they could hear the deep voice of a single speaker. Several minutes later the door to the chamber opened, and Minyan, looking flushed but otherwise quite well, was briskly ushered in by two dwarf guards. When they were left alone, the Highlander explained that they had come for him the same as for the Vale men. From snatches of conversation he had heard on the way over, it appeared that the dwarfs in Cullhaven, and probably all of the Anar, were preparing for war. Whatever news Alanon had brought back with him had thrown matters into a state of confusion in the dwarf community. He thought he had caught a quick glimpse of Balinor through the open doors of the assembly hall, standing on the platform at the front of the building, but the guards had rushed him past, and he couldn't be sure. The voices from the congregation next door rose in a thunderous roar, and all three paused expectantly. Seconds passed as the shouting continued to roll through the large hall, spreading to the open grounds outside where it was taken up by the dwarfs there. At the deafening peak of the shouting, the door to their room suddenly burst open to admit the dark, commanding figure of Al-Anon. He walked over to the Veil Men quickly, shook their hands, and congratulated them on their successful journey to Cullhaven. He was dressed as he had been when Flick had first encountered him, his lean face half hidden in the long cowl, his whole appearance dark and foreboding. He greeted Menyon courteously and moved to the head of the nearest table, motioning the others to be seated. He had been followed into the room by Balinor and a number of dwarfs, who were apparently leaders in the community, among them the irascible Hendel. Bringing up the rear of this procession were two slim, almost shadowy figures in curious, loose-fitting woodsman garb, who quietly took seats near Al-Anon at the head of the table. Shay could see them clearly from his position at the other end, and concluded after a quick observation that they were elves from the distant Westland. Their keen features, from the sharply raised eyebrows to the strange pointed ears, marked them distinctively. Shay turned back and saw that both Flick and Menyon were looking at him curiously, obviously appraising his own strong resemblance to the strangers. None of them had ever seen an elf, and while they knew that Shay was half-elf and had heard descriptions given of the elven people, none had ever had a chance to compare the Veilmen to one. "My friends," the deep voice of Al-Anon boomed out in the slight stir of voices as he rose commandingly to his full height of 7 feet. The room was instantly silent as all faces turned in his direction. "My friends, I must now tell you what I have as yet told no one else. We have suffered a tragic loss." He paused and looked at the anxious faces in turn. "Paranor has fallen. A division of gnome hunters under the command of the warlock lord has seized the Sword of Shannara." There was dead silence for about 2 seconds before the dwarfs were on their feet, shouting in anger. Balinor rose quickly in an effort to quiet them. Shay and Flick looked at each other in disbelief. Only Menyon seemed unsurprised by the announcement, his lean face carefully scrutinizing the dark figure at the head of the table. "Paranor was taken from within," Al-Anon continued after some semblance of order had been restored. "There is little question as to the fate of those who guarded the fortress and the sword. I am told that all were executed. No one knows exactly how it happened." "Have you been there?" Shay asked suddenly, feeling almost immediately that it was a stupid question. "I left your home in the Vale so suddenly because I received word that an attempt would be made to secure Paranor. I arrived too late to help those within and barely escaped detection myself. That is one of the reasons I am so late in reaching Cullhaven." "But if Paranor has fallen and the sword been taken..." Flick's whispered question trailed off ominously. "Then what can we do now?" Al-Anon finished harshly. "This is the problem facing us, the one we must provide an immediate answer for. The reason for this council." Al-Anon suddenly left his position at the head of the long table and moved around until he was standing directly behind Shay. He placed one great hand on the slim shoulder and faced his attentive audience. "The Sword of Shannara is useless in the hands of the warlock lord. It can only be raised by a son of the House of Gerald Shannara. This alone prevents the evil one from striking now.
Instead, he has systematically hunted down and destroyed all members of that house, one at a time, one after another, even those I tried to protect. All whom I could find. Now they are all dead. All save one. And that one is young Shay. Shay is only half elf, but he is a direct descendant of the king who carried the great sword so many years before. Now he must raise it once again. Shay would have bolted for the door if it had not been for the strong hand gripping his shoulder. He looked desperately at Flick and saw the fear in his own eyes mirrored in those of his brothers. Minion had not moved, but appeared visibly impressed by this grim declaration. What Elanon seemed to expect from Shay was more than any man had the right to ask. "Well, I think we have shaken our young friend a bit." Elanon laughed shortly. "Do not despair, Shay. Things are not as bad as they may seem to you right now." He turned abruptly, walked back to the head of the table, and faced the others. "We must recover the sword at all costs. There is no other choice left to us. If we fail to do this, the whole of the land will be plunged into the greatest war the races have seen since the near destruction of life 2,000 years ago. The sword is the key. Without it, we must fall back on our mortal strength, our fighting prowess. A battle with iron and muscle that can only result in uncountable thousands dying on both sides. The evil is the warlock lord, and he cannot be destroyed without the aid of the sword, and the courage of a few men, not the least of whom must be those of us in this room." Again he paused to measure the force of his words. There was absolute silence as he looked doubtfully at the silent gallery of grim faces staring back. Suddenly, Menyon Lee rose at the far end of the table and faced the giant speaker. "What you are suggesting is that we go after the sword. To Perrinor." Elanon nodded slowly, a half-smile playing over his thin lips as he waited for a reaction from the startled listeners. His deep-set eyes twinkled blackly beneath the great brow, watching carefully the faces about him. Menyon sat down slowly, total disbelief showing plainly on his handsome features, as Elanon continued. "The sword is still at Perrinor. There is an excellent possibility that it will remain there. Neither Brona nor the bearers of the skull can personally remove the talisman. Its mere physical presence is an anathema to their continued existence in the mortal world. Any form of exposure for more than several minutes would cause excruciating pain. This means that any attempt to transport the sword north to the Skull Kingdom must be accomplished by use of the gnomes that hold Perrinor. Eventine and his elven warriors were given the task of securing the druid stronghold and the sword. While Perrinor has been lost to us, the elves still hold the southern stretch of the Strelaheim, north of the fortress, and any attempt to travel north to the Dark Lord would require breaking through their patrols. Apparently, Eventine was not at Perrinor when it was taken, and I have no reason to believe that he will not endeavor to regain the sword, or at the very least, thwart any attempt to remove it. The Warlock Lord will be aware of this, and I do not think he will risk losing the weapon by having the gnomes carry it out. Instead, he will entrench at Perrinor until his army moves south. There is a possibility that the Warlock Lord does not expect us to attempt to regain the sword. He may believe that the House of Shannara has been exterminated,
He may expect us to concentrate on strengthening our defenses against his forthcoming assault. If we act immediately, a small party may be able to slip into the keep undetected and retrieve the sword. Such an undertaking would be dangerous, but if there is even the remotest chance of success, the risk is worth it. Balinor had risen and indicated he wished to speak to those assembled. Alanon nodded and sat down. I do not understand the power of the sword over the warlock lord. That much I freely admit, the tall warrior began. But I do know the threat that we all face if Brona's army invades the Southland and the Anar, as our reports indicate it is preparing to do. My homeland will be the first to face this threat, and if I can prevent it in any way, then I cannot do otherwise. I will go with Alanon. The dwarfs leaped up again at this point and enthusiastically shouted their support. Alanon stood up and raised his long arm in a plea for silence. These two young elves at my side are cousins of Eventine. They will accompany me. For their sake, in this matter, is at least as great as your own. Balinor will go as well, and I will take one of the dwarf chieftains, no more. This must be a small, highly skilled party of hunters if we are to succeed. Pick the best man among you, and let him come with us. He looked to the end of the table where Shay and Flick sat watching in a mixed state of shock and confusion. Minyan Lee pondered quietly, looking at no one in particular. Alanon glanced expectantly at Shay, his grim face suddenly softening as he saw the frightened eyes of the young Veilman who had come so far, through so many dangers, to this apparent haven of safety, only to be told that he was expected to leave it for an even more perilous trip northward. But there had been no time to break the news to the Veilman in a gentle way. He shook his head doubtfully and waited. I think I had better go. The abrupt declaration came from Menyon, who had again risen to his feet to face the others. I came with Shay this far to be certain he reached the safety of Cullhaven, which he has done. My duty to him is finished, but I owe it to my homeland and to my people to protect them in any way I can. What can you offer, then? Asked Alanon abruptly, astonished that the Highlander would volunteer without first speaking to his friends. Shay and Flick were clearly dumbfounded by this unexpected announcement. I'm the best bowman in the Southland, Menyon answered smoothly. Probably the best tracker as well. Alanon seemed to hesitate for a moment, then looked to Balinor, who quietly shrugged. For a brief moment, Menyon and Alanon locked gazes, as if to judge each other's intentions. Menyon smiled coldly at the grim historian. Why should I answer to you? He queried shortly. The dark figure at the other end of the table stared at him almost curiously, and a deathly silence settled over the company. Even Balinor stepped back one short pace in shock. Shane knew instantly that Menyon was asking for trouble, and that everyone at the table except the three companions knew something about the foreboding Alanon. They did not. The frightened Veilman shot a quick look at Flick, whose flushed face had gone pale at the thought of a confrontation between the two men. Desperate to avoid any trouble, Shay stood up suddenly and cleared his throat. Everyone looked in his direction, and his mind went blank. "You have something to say?" demanded Alanon blackly. Shay nodded, and his mind raced desperately, knowing what was expected. He looked again to Flick, who managed a barely perceptible nod indicating that he would go along with whatever his brother decided. Shay cleared his throat a second time. My special skill appears to be that I was born in the wrong family.
but I had better see this matter through. Flick and I, Minion, too, will go to Paranor.
Al-Anon nodded his approval and even managed a slight smile, inwardly pleased with the young Veilman. Shay, more than any of the others, had to be strong. He was the last son of the House of Shannara, and the fate of so many would depend on that single, small chance of birth. At the other end of the table, Minyan Lee relaxed quietly in his seat, a barely audible sigh of relief escaping his lips as he silently congratulated himself. He had deliberately provoked Al-Anon, and in so doing, had forced Shay to come to his rescue by agreeing to go to Paranor. It had been a desperate gamble to induce the little Veilman to make up his mind that he was going with them. The Highlander had come close to what might have been a fatal confrontation with Al-Anon. He had been lucky. He wondered if luck would smile on all of them during the journey ahead. Chapter 9. Shay stood quietly in the darkness outside the assembly hall and let the night air wash over his hot face in cool waves. Flick was immediately to his right, the broad face grim in the shadowed moonlight. Minyan leaned idly against a tall oak some yards off to their left. The meeting had concluded and Al-Anon had asked them to wait for him. The tall wanderer was still inside, making preparations with the dwarf elders to counter the expected invasion from the Upper Anar. Balinor was with them, coordinating the defense of the famed Border Legion in distant Calahorn with that of the dwarf army of the Eastland. Shay was relieved to be out of the stuffy little room, out in the open night where he could consider more clearly his hasty decision to go with the company to Paranor. He knew, and he guessed Flick must have known as well, that they could not expect to stay out of the inevitable conflict centering around the Sword of Shannara. They could have stayed in Cullhaven, living almost like prisoners, hoping that the dwarf people would protect them from the searching skullbearers. They could have stayed in this strange land, apart from all who knew them, perhaps forgotten in time by everyone except the dwarfs. But to alienate themselves that way would have been worse than any imaginable fate at the hands of the enemy. For the first time, Shay realized that he must accept the fact, finally and forever, that he was no longer merely the adopted son of Curzat Ohmsford. He was a son of the elven House of Shannara, the son of kings and the heir to the fabled sword, and though he would have wished it otherwise, he must accept what chance had decreed for him. He looked quietly at his brother, who stood lost in thought, staring at the darkened earth, and he felt a keen pang of sorrow at the remembrance of the other's loyalty. Flick was courageous and loved him, but he had not bargained for this unexpected turn of events that would take them into the heart of the enemy's country. Shay did not want Flick to be involved in this matter. It was not his responsibility. He knew that the stocky Veilman would never desert him so long as he felt he could help. But perhaps now Flick could be persuaded to remain behind, even to return to Shady Vale to explain to their father what had befallen them. But even as he toyed with the idea, he discarded it, knowing that Flick would never turn back. Whatever else happened, he would see this matter through. "There was a time," Flick's quiet voice broke into his thoughts, "when I would have sworn that I would live out my life in uneventful solitude in Shady Vale. Now it appears that I will be a part of an effort to save mankind." "Do you think I should have chosen otherwise?" Shay asked after a moment's silent thought. "No, I don't think so." Flick shook his head. "But remember what we talked about on the trip here, about things being beyond our control, even our understanding. You see how little control we now have over what's to become of us." He paused and looked squarely over to his brother. "I think you made the right choice, and whatever happens, I'll be with you." Shay smiled broadly and placed a hand on the other's shoulder, thinking to himself
that this was exactly what he had predicted Flick would say. It was a small gesture, perhaps, but one that meant more to him than any other could have. He was aware of the sudden approach of Menyon from the other side and turned to face the Highlander.
"I suppose you think me some sort of fool after what happened in there tonight," Menyon stated abruptly. "But this fool stands along with old Flick. Whatever happens, we'll face it together, be it mortal or spirit."
"You caused that scene in there to get Shay to agree to go, didn't you?" an irate Flick demanded. "That's the lowest trick I have ever witnessed."
"Never mind, Flick," Shay cut him short. "Menyon knew what he was doing, and he did the right thing. I would have decided to go anyway. At least I'd like to believe I would. Now we've got to forget the past, forget our differences, and stand together for our own preservation."
"As long as I stand where I can see him," retorted his brother bitterly.
The door to the conference room opened suddenly, and the broad figure of Balinor was silhouetted in the torchlight from within. He surveyed the three men standing just beyond him in the darkness, then closed the door and walked over to them, smiling slightly as he approached.
"I'm glad you decided to come with us. All of you," he stated simply. "I must add, Shay, that without you, the trip would have been pointless. Without the heir of General Shannara, the sword is only so much metal."
"What can you tell us about this magic weapon?" Menyon asked quickly.
"I leave that to Alanon," replied Balinor. "He plans to speak with you here in just a few minutes."
Menyon nodded, inwardly disturbed at the prospect of encountering the tall man again that evening, but curious to hear more about the power of the sword. Shay and Flick exchanged quick glances. At last they would learn the full story behind what was happening in the Northland.
"Why are you here, Balinor?" Flick asked cautiously, not wishing to pry into the Borderman's personal affairs.
"It's a rather long story. You would not be interested," replied the other almost sharply, immediately causing Flick to believe he had overstepped his bounds. Balinor saw his chagrined look and smiled reassuringly.
"My family and I have not been on very good terms lately. My younger brother and I have had a disagreement, and I wanted to leave the city for a while. Alanon asked me to accompany him to the Anar. Hendel and the others were old friends, so I agreed."
"Sounds like a familiar tale," commented Menyon dryly.
"I've had some problems like that myself from time to time."
Balinor nodded and managed a half-smile, but Shay could tell from his eyes that he did not consider this a laughing matter. Whatever had caused him to leave Callahorn was more serious than anything Menyon had ever encountered in Lee. Shay quickly changed the subject.
"What can you tell us about Alanon? We seem to be placing an unusual amount of trust in him, and we still know absolutely nothing about the man. Who is he?"
Balinor arched his eyebrows and smiled, amused by the question and, at the same time, uncertain as to how it should be answered. He walked away from them a little, thinking to himself, and then turned back abruptly and motioned vaguely toward the assembly hall.
"I really don't know much about Alanon myself," he admitted frankly. "He travels a great deal, exploring the country, recording in his notes the changes and growth of the land and its people. He's well known in all the nations. I think he's been everywhere. The extent of his knowledge of this world is extraordinary. Most of it isn't in any book. He is very remarkable."
"But who is he?" Shay persisted eagerly, feeling that he must learn the true origin of the historian.
"I can't say for certain, because he has never confided completely, even in me. And I am almost like a son to him," Balinor stated very quietly, so softly, in fact, that they all moved a bit closer to be certain they missed nothing of what was to follow. "The elders of the dwarfs and of my own kingdom say that he is the greatest of the druids,
that almost forgotten council that governed men over 1,000 years ago. They say that he is a direct descendant of the druid Bremen, perhaps even of Gallifile himself. I think there is more than a little truth in that statement, because he went to Paranor often and stayed for long periods, recording his findings in the great record books stored there. He paused for a moment, and his three listeners glanced at each other, wondering if the grim historian could actually be a direct descendant of the druids, thinking in awe of the centuries of history behind the man. Shay had suspected before that Al-Anon was one of the ancient philosopher teachers known as druids, and it seemed apparent that the man possessed a greater knowledge of the races and the origins of the threat facing them than did anyone else. He turned back to Balinor, who was speaking again. I can't explain it, but I don't believe we could be in better company for any peril, even were we to come face to face with the warlock lord himself. Though I haven't one shred of concrete evidence, nor even an example to cite you, I'm certain that Al-Anon's power is beyond anything we have ever seen. He would be a very, very dangerous enemy. Of that, I haven't the slightest doubt, Flick muttered dryly. Only minutes later, the door of the conference room opened and Al-Anon stepped quietly into view. In the half-light of the moon, he was huge and forbidding, almost a replica of the dreaded skull-bearers they feared so much, the dark cape billowing slightly as he moved toward them, his lean face hidden in the depths of the long cowl about his head. They were silent as he approached, wondering what he would tell them, what it would mean for them in the days ahead. Perhaps he knew their thoughts instinctively as he walked up to them, but their eyes could not pierce the mask of inscrutability that cloaked his grim features and sheltered the man buried within. They could only see the sudden glint of his eyes as he stopped before them and looked slowly from one face to the next. A deep silence settled ominously over the little group. The time has come for you to learn the full story behind the Sword of Shannara, to learn the history of the races, as only I know it to be. His voice reached out and drew them commandingly to him. It is essential that Shay should understand, and since the rest of you share the risks involved, you should also know the truth. What you will learn tonight must be kept in confidence, until I tell you it no longer matters. This will be hard, but you must do it. He motioned for them to follow him and moved away from the clearing, drawing them deeper into the darkness of the trees beyond. When they were several hundred feet into the forest, he turned into a small, almost hidden clearing. He seated himself on the worn stub of an ancient trunk and motioned the others to find a place. They did so quickly and waited in silence as the famous historian gathered his thoughts and prepared to speak. A very long time ago, he began finally, still considering his explanation as he spoke, before the great wars, before the existence of the races as we know them today, the land was, or was thought to be, populated only by man. Civilization had developed even before then for many thousands of years. Years of hard toil and learning that brought man to a point where he was on the verge of mastering the secrets of life itself. It was a fabulous, exciting time to live in, so expansive that much of it would be totally beyond your comprehension were I empowered to draw you the most perfect picture. But while man worked all those years to discover the secrets of life, he never managed to escape his overpowering fascination for death. It was a constant alternative, even in the most civilized of the nations. Strangely enough, the catalyst of each new discovery was the same endless pursuit, the study of science. Not the science the races know today. Not the study of animal life, plant life, the earth, and the simple arts. This was a science of machines and power, one that divided itself into infinite fields of exploration, all of which worked toward the same two ends. Discovering better ways to live, or quicker ways to kill. He paused and laughed grimly to himself, cocking his head in the direction of the attentive Balinor. Very strange indeed when you think about it, that man should spend so much time working toward two such obviously different goals. Even now, nothing has changed, even after all these years. His voice trailed off for a moment, and Shay risked a brief look at the others, but their eyes were fixed on the speaker. Sciences of physical power! Alanon's sudden exclamation brought Shay's head around with a snap. These were the means to all the ends of that era. 2,000 years ago, the achievements of the human race were unparalleled in Earth's history. Man's age-old enemy, death, could now claim only those who had lived out their natural lifetime. Sickness was virtually eliminated, and given a bit more time, man would even have found a way to prolong life. Some philosophers claimed that the secrets of life were forbidden to mortals. No one had ever proved otherwise. They might have done so, but their time ran out, and the same elements of power that had made life free from sickness and infirmity nearly destroyed it altogether. The great wars began, building gradually from smaller disputes between a few peoples, and spreading steadily, despite the realization of what was happening, spreading from little matters into basic hatreds. Race, nationality, boundaries, creeds. In the end, everything. Then suddenly, so suddenly that few people knew what happened, the entire world was enveloped in a series of retaliatory attacks by the different countries, all very scientifically planned and executed. In a matter of minutes, the science of thousands of years, the learning of centuries, culminated in an almost total destruction of life. The Great Wars. The deep voice was grim, the glint of the dark eyes watching carefully the faces of his listeners. Very apt name. The power expended in those few minutes of battle not only succeeded in wiping out those thousands of years of human growth, but it also began a series of explosions and upheavals that completely altered the surface of the land. The initial force did most of the damage, killing every living thing over 90% of the face of the earth, but the after-effects carried on the alteration and extinction, breaking the continents apart, drying up oceans, making lands and seas uninhabitable for several hundred years. It should have been the end of all life, perhaps the end of the world itself. Only a miracle prevented that end.
I can't believe it.
The words slipped out before Shay could catch himself, and Alanon looked toward him, the familiar mocking smile spreading over his lips. "That's your history of civilized man, Shay," he murmured darkly. "But what happened thereafter concerns us more directly. Remnants of the race of man managed to survive during the terrible period following the Holocaust, living in isolated sectors of the globe, fighting the elements for survival. This was the beginning of the development of the races as they are today. Men, dwarfs, gnomes, trolls, and some say the elves. But they were always there, and that's another story for another time." Alanon had made exactly the same comment concerning the elven people to the Ohmsford brothers in Shady Vale. Shay wanted badly to stop the narration at that point to ask about the race of elves and about his own origin. But he knew better than to irritate the tall historian by breaking in, as he had several times during their first meeting. Few men remembered the secrets of the sciences that had shaped their way of life prior to the destruction of the old world. Only a few remembered. Most were little more than primitive creatures, and the few could recollect only bits and pieces of knowledge. But they had kept their books of learning intact, and these could tell them most of the secrets of the old sciences. They kept them hidden and secure during that first several hundred years, unable to put the words to practical use, waiting for the time when they might. They read their precious texts instead, and then, as the books themselves began to crumble with age, and there was no way to preserve them or copy them, those few men who possessed the books began to memorize the information. The years passed, and the knowledge was passed down carefully from father to son, each generation keeping the knowledge safely within the family, guarding it from those who didn't use it wisely, who might create a world in which the great wars could happen a second time. In the end, even after it once again became possible to record the information in those irreplaceable books, the men who had memorized them declined to do so. They were still afraid of the consequences, afraid of each other, and even themselves. So they decided, individually for the most part, to wait for the right time to offer their knowledge to the growing new races. The years passed in this way as the new races slowly began to develop beyond the stage of primitive life. They began to unify into communities, trying to build a new life out of the dust of the old. But as you have already been told, they did not prove equal to the task. They quarreled violently over land, petty disputes which soon turned to armed conflict between the races. It was then when the sons of those who had first kept the secrets of the old life, the old sciences, saw that matters were steadily regressing toward the very thing that had destroyed the old world, that they decided to act. The man called Gallifile saw what was happening and realized that if nothing were done, the races would surely be at war. So he called together a select group of men, all he could find who possessed any knowledge of the old books, to a council at Paranor. "So that was the first druid council," murmured Menyon Lee in wonder. "A council of all the knowledgeable men of that era, pooling their learning to save the races." "A very praiseworthy effort at explaining, a desperate attempt to prevent extermination of life," laughed Alanon shortly. "The Druid Council was formed with the best intentions on the part of most, perhaps all at first. They exerted a tremendous influence over the races because they were capable of offering so much to make life considerably better for everyone. They operated strictly as a group, each man contributing his knowledge for the benefit of all. Although they succeeded in preventing an outbreak of total war, and kept peace between the races at first, they encountered unexpected problems. The knowledge that each possessed had become unavoidably altered in small ways in the telling from generation to generation, so that many of the key understandings were different than they had been. Complicating the situation was an understandable inability to coordinate the different materials, the knowledge of the different sciences. For many of the council members, the learning passed down to them by their ancestors lacked meaning in practical terms, and much of it appeared to be so many jumbled words. So while the druids, as they called themselves after an ancient group who sought understanding, were able to aid the races in many ways, they found themselves unable to piece together enough out of the texts they had memorized to master readily any of the important concepts of the great sciences. The concepts they felt certain would help the country to grow and prosper. "Then the druids wanted the old world rebuilt on their terms," spoke up Shay quickly.
They wanted to prevent the wars that had destroyed them the first time, yet recreate the benefits of all the old sciences.
Flick shook his head in bewilderment, unable to see what all this had to do with the warlock lord and the sword.
Correct, Alanon noted. But the Druid Council, for all its vast knowledge and good intentions, overlooked a basic concept of human existence. Whenever an intelligent creature possesses an innate desire to improve its conditions, to unlock the secrets of progress, it will find the means to do so. If not by one method, then by another. The druids secluded themselves at Perenor, away from the races of the land, while they worked alone or in small groups to master the secrets of the old sciences. Most relied on the material at hand, the knowledge of individual members related to that of the entire council, to try to rebuild and reconstruct the old means of harnessing power. But some were not content with this approach. A few felt that, instead of trying to understand the words and thoughts of the ancient recollections better, such knowledge as could be immediately grasped should be acted upon and developed in connection with new ideas, new rationalizations. So it was that a few members of the council, acting under the leadership of one called Broner, began to delve into the ancient mysteries without waiting for a full understanding of the old sciences. They had phenomenal minds, genius in a few instances, and they were eager to succeed, impatient to master the power that would be so useful to the races. But by a strange quirk of fate, their discoveries and their developments led them further and further from the studies of the council. The old sciences were puzzles without answers for them, and so they deviated into other fields of thought, slowly and relentlessly intertwining themselves in a realm of study that none had ever mastered, and none called science. What they began to unveil was the infinite power of the mystic. Sorcery. They mastered a few of the secrets of the mystic before they were discovered by the council and commanded to abandon their work. There was a violent disagreement, and the followers of Broner left the council in anger, determined to continue their own approach. They disappeared and were not seen again. He paused for a moment, considering his explanation. His listeners waited impatiently. We know now what happened in the years that followed. During his prolonged studies, Broner uncovered the deepest secrets of sorcery and mastered them. But in the process, he lost his own identity, eventually even his own soul, to the powers he had sought so eagerly. Forgotten were the old sciences and their purpose in the world of man. Forgotten was the Druid Council and its goal of a better world. Forgotten was everything but the driving urge to learn more of the mystic arts, the secrets of the mind's power to reach into other worlds. Broner was obsessed with the need to extend his power, to dominate men and the world they inhabited through mastery of this terrible force. The result of this ambition was the infamous First War of the Races, when he gained domination over the weak and confused minds of the race of man, causing that hapless people to make war on the other races, subjecting them to the will of the man who was no longer a man, who was no longer even the master of himself. And his followers, asked Minion slowly, victims of the same. They became servants to their leader, all slaves of the strange power of sorcery. Alanon trailed off hesitantly, as if to add something but uncertain of its effect on his listeners. Thinking better of it, he continued.
The fact that these unfortunate druids stumbled onto the very opposite of what they were seeking is in itself a lesson to man. Perhaps with patience they might have pieced together the missing links to the old sciences, rather than uncovering the terrible power of the spirit world that fed eagerly on their unprotected minds until they were devoured. Human minds are not equipped to face the realities of non-material existence on this sphere. It is too much for any mortal to bear for long. Again he trailed off into ominous silence. The listeners now understood the nature of the enemy they were trying to outwit. They were up against a man who was no longer a human, but the projection of some great force beyond their own comprehension, a force so powerful that Al-Anon feared it could affect the human mind. "The rest you already know," Al-Anon began again rather sharply. "The creature called Brona, who no longer resembled anything human, was the directing force behind both of the race wars. The Skull-Bearers are the followers of their old master Brona, those druids once human in form, once a part of the Council at Perenor. They cannot escape their fate any more than he can. The very forms they take are an embodiment of the evil they represent. But more important for our purposes, they represent a new age for mankind, for all the people of the four lands. While the old sciences have disappeared into our history, forgotten now as completely as the years when machines were the godsend of an easy life, the enchantment of sorcery has replaced them. A more powerful, more dangerous threat to human life than any before it. Do not doubt me, my friends. We live in the age of the sorcerer, and his power threatens to consume us all." There was a moment of silence. A deep stillness hung oppressively in the forest night as Al-Anon's final words seemed to echo back with ringing sharpness. Then Shay spoke softly.
"What is the secret of the Sword of Shannara?"
"In the first War of the Races," Al-Anon replied in almost a whisper, "the power of the druid Brona was limited. As a result, the combined might of the other races, coupled with the knowledge of the druid council, defeated his army of men and drove him into hiding. He might have ceased to be, and the whole incident been written off as merely another chapter in history. Another war between mortals. Except that he managed to unlock the secret of perpetuating his spiritual essence long after his mortal remains should have decomposed and turned to dust. Somehow he preserved his own spirit, feeding it on the power of the mystic forces he now possessed, giving it a life apart from materiality, apart from mortality. He now was able to bridge the two worlds, the world we live in and the spirit world beyond, where he summoned the black wraiths that had for centuries lain dormant and waited for his time to strike back. As he waited, he watched the races drift apart as he knew they must in time, and the power of the druid council wane as their interest in the races grew lax. As with all things evil, he waited until the balance of hatred, envy, greed, the human failings common to all the races, outweighed the goodness and kindness. And then he struck. Gaining easy control of the primitive, warlike rock trolls of the Charnel Mountains, he reinforced their numbers with creatures of the spirit world he now served, and his army marched on the divided races. As you know, they crushed the druid council and destroyed it, all save a few who fled to safety. One of those who escaped was an aged mystic named Bremen, who had foreseen the danger and in vain attempted to warn the others. As a druid,
He was originally a historian, and in that capacity had studied the First War of the Races and learned of Brona and his followers. Intrigued by what they had attempted to do, and suspicious that perhaps the mysterious druid had acquired powers that no one had known about, nor could have hoped to combat, Bremen began his own study of the mystic arts. But with greater care and respect for the possible power he felt he might unlock. After several years of this pursuit, he became convinced that Brona was indeed still existent, and that the next war upon the human race would be started and eventually decided by the powers of sorcery and black magic. You can imagine the response he received to this theory. He was practically thrown from the confines of Perenor. As a result, he began to master the mystic art on his own, and so was not present when the castle at Perenor fell to the troll army. When he learned that the council had been taken, he knew that if he did not act, the races would be left defenseless against the enchantment Brona had mastered, power that mortals knew nothing about. But he was faced with the problem of how to defeat a creature who could not be touched by any mortal weapon, one who had survived for over 500 years. He went to the greatest nation of his time, the elven people under the command of a courageous young king named Gerald Shannara, and offered his assistance. The elven people had always respected Bremen, because they understood him better than even his fellow druids. He had lived among them for years prior to the fall of Perenor, while studying the science of the mystic. "There is something I don't understand," Balinor spoke up suddenly. "If Bremen was a master of the mystic arts, why could he not himself challenge the power of the warlock lord?" Alanon's response was somehow evasive. "He did confront Brona in the end on the plains of Strelaheim, though it was not a battle that was visible to mortal eyes, and both disappeared. It was presumed that Bremen had defeated the Spirit King, but time has proven otherwise. And now..." He hesitated only an instant before quickly returning to his narrative, but the emphasis on the pause was not lost on any of his listeners. "In any event, Bremen realized that what was needed was a talisman to serve as a shield against the possible return of one such as Brona at another time, when there was no one familiar with the mystic arts to offer assistance to the peoples of the Four Lands. So he conceived the idea of the sword, a weapon which would contain the power to defeat the warlock lord. Bremen forged the sword of Shannara with the aid of his own mystic prowess, shaping it with more than the mere metal of our own world, giving it that special protective characteristic of all talismans against the unknown. The sword was to draw its strength from the minds of the mortals for whom it acted as a shield. The power of the sword was their own desire to remain free, to give up even their lives to preserve that freedom. This was the power which enabled Gerald Shannara to destroy the spirit-dominated Northland army then. It is the same power that must now be used to send the warlock lord back into the limbo world to which he belongs, to imprison him there for all eternity, to cut off entirely his passage back to this world. But as long as he has the sword, then he has a chance to prevent its power from being used to destroy him forever. And that, my friends, is the one thing that must not be."
"But then why is it that only a son of the House of Shannara?"
The question formed on Shay's fumbling lips, his own mind reeling confusedly. "That is the greatest irony of all," exclaimed Alanon before the question was even completed. "If you have followed all that I have related about the change of life following the Great Wars, the giving way of the old materialistic sciences to the science of the present age, the science of the mystic,
then you will understand what I am about to explain. The strangest phenomenon of all. While the sciences of old operated on practical theories built around things that could be seen and touched and felt, the sorcery of our own time operates on an entirely different principle. Its power is potent only when it is believed, for it is power over the mind which can neither be touched nor seen through human senses. If the mind does not truly find some basis for belief in its existence, then it can have no real effect. The Warlock Lord realizes this, and the mind's fear of and belief in the unknown, the worlds, the creatures, all the occurrences that cannot be understood by men's limited senses, offer him more than enough basis upon which to practice the mystic arts. He has been relying on this premise for over 500 years. In the same way, the Sword of Shannara cannot be an effective weapon unless the one holding it believes in his power to use it. When Bremen gave the sword to Gerald Shannara, he made the mistake of giving it directly to a king and to the house of a king. He did not give it to the people of the lands. As a result, through human misunderstanding and historical misconception, the universal belief grew that the sword was the weapon of the elven king alone, and that only those descended of his blood could take up the sword against the warlock lord. So now, unless it is held by a son of the House of Shannara, that person can never fully believe in his right to use it. The ancient tradition that only such a one can wield it will make all others doubt. And there must be no doubt, or it will not operate. Instead, it will become merely another piece of metal. Only the blood and belief of a descendant of Shannara can invoke the latent power of the great sword. He concluded. The silence that followed was hollow. There was nothing left to tell the four that could be told. Al-Anon reconsidered briefly what he had promised himself. He had not told them everything, purposely holding back the little more that would have proved the final terror for them. He inwardly felt torn between the desire to have it all out and the gnawing realization that it would destroy any chance of success. Their success was of paramount importance. Only he knew the full truth of that fact. So he sat in silence, bitter in his private knowledge and angered by the self-imposed limits he had set for himself, the limits that forbade a complete revelation to those who had come to depend upon him so very heavily. "Then only Shay can use the sword if..." Balinor broke the silence abruptly. "Only Shay has the birthright. Only Shay." It was so quiet that even the night life of the forest seemed to have stilled its incessant chatter in sober contemplation of the grim historian's reply. The future came down to each as a simple declaration of existence. Succeed or be destroyed. "Leave me now," commanded Al-Anon suddenly. "Sleep while you can. We leave this haven at sunrise for the halls of Perenor." Chapter 10. The morning came quickly for the small company, and the golden half-light of dawn found them preparing to begin their long journey with sleep-filled eyes. Balinor, Menion, and the Veilmen waited for the appearance of Al-Anon and the cousins of Eventine. No one spoke, partly because each was still half asleep and had very little to recommend him in the way of good humor, and partly because each was inwardly thinking about the hazardous trip that lay ahead.
Shay and Flick sat quietly on a small stone bench, not looking at each other as they considered the tale Al-Anon had related to them the previous night, wondering what possible chance they had of recovering the Sword of Shannara, using it against the warlock lord to destroy him, and still returning alive to their homeland. Shay particularly had passed the point where his chief emotion was fear. Now he felt only a sense of numbness that dulled his mind into self-imposed surrender, a robot-like acceptance of the fact that he was being led to the proverbial slaughter. Yet in spite of this resigned attitude toward the journey to Perrinor, somewhere in the back of his confused mind was the lingering belief that he could work out all of these seemingly insurmountable obstacles. He could feel it lurking there, waiting for a more opportune moment to arise and demand satisfaction. But for the moment, he allowed himself to lapse dutifully into numbed acquiescence. The Vale Men were dressed in woodsman garb provided by the dwarf people, including warm half-cloaks in which they now wrapped themselves to ward off the chill of the early morning. In addition, they carried the short hunting knives they had brought with them from the Vale, tucked in their leather belts. Their packs were necessarily compact, in accord with the Vailmen's small size. The country they would pass through offered some of the best hunting in all the Southland, and there were several small communities friendly to Al-Anon and the dwarfs. But it was also the home of the gnome people, the long-time bitter enemies of the dwarfs. There was some hope the little band would be able to maintain an advantage of stealth and secrecy in their travel and avoid any confrontation with gnome hunters. Shay had carefully packed away the elf stones in their leather pouch, showing them to no one. Al-Anon had not mentioned them since he had arrived in Cullhaven. Whether this was an oversight or not, Shay was not about to give up the one really potent weapon that he possessed, and kept the pouch hidden within his tunic. Minyan Lee stood several yards away from the brothers, pacing idly. He wore particularly nondescript hunting clothes, loose-fitting and colored to blend with the land to make his task as tracker and huntsman as uncomplicated as possible. His shoes were soft leather, toughened by certain oils to enable him to stalk anything without being heard and still travel the toughest ground without injuring the soles of his feet. Strapped to his lean back was the great sword, sheathed now, its strong hilt glinting dully in the early light as he shifted restlessly about. Across his shoulder he carried the long ash bow and its arrows, his favorite weapon on hunting trips. Balinor wore the familiar long hunting cloak wrapped closely about his tall, broad frame, the cowl pulled up around his head. Beneath the cloak was the chainmail, which could be seen glinting sharply ever so often as his arms emerged in brief gestures from beneath the shielding of the garment. He carried in his belt a long hunting knife and the most enormous sword that the Vailmen had ever seen. It was so huge that it appeared to them that one sweep of its great blade would cut through a man completely. It was hidden beneath the cloak at the moment, but the brothers had seen him strap it to his side as he came out to them earlier that morning. Their waiting finally came to an end as Al-Anon approached from the assembly hall, accompanied by the lithe figures of the two elves. Without stopping, he bade them all good morning and directed them to fall into line for the trip, warning sharply that once they crossed the Silver River several miles ahead, they would be in country traveled by gnomes, and that conversation must be kept to a minimum. Their route would take them from the river directly north through the Anar forests into the mountains that lay beyond. There was less chance that they would be detected traveling through this rough country than across the plains that lay farther west, where the terrain was admittedly more even and accessible. Secrecy was the key to their success. If the purpose of their journey became known to the warlock lord, they were finished. Travel would be restricted to the daylight hours while they were camouflaged by the forests and mountains, and they would resort to night travel and risk detection by the searching skull-bearers only when they were forced to cross the plains many miles to the north. As their representative on the expedition, the dwarf chieftain had chosen Hendel, the close-mouthed fellow who had saved Menyon from the siren. Hendel led the company out of Cullhaven, since he was the most familiar with this part of the country. At his side walked Menyon, talking only occasionally, concentrating mostly on staying out of the sullen dwarf's way and trying to avoid drawing attention to his presence, something the dwarf felt was totally unnecessary. Several paces back from them were the two elves, their slim figures like brief shadows as they moved gracefully, effortlessly, speaking with each other in quiet, musical voices that Shay found reassuring. Both carried long ash bows similar to Menyon's. They wore no cloaks, only the strange, close-fitting outfits they had worn at the council the night before. Shay and Flick followed them, and behind the veilmen walked the silent leader of the company, his long strides covering the ground with ease, his dark face lowered to the trail. Balinor brought up the rear. Both Shay and Flick were quick to realize that their position in the center of the company was to assure their maximum protection. Shay knew how valuable the others felt he was to the success of the mission, but he was also painfully aware that they considered him incapable of defending himself in case of any real danger. The company reached the Silver River and crossed at a narrow spot where the winding thread of gleaming water was spanned by a sturdy wooden bridge. All talking ceased once they had passed over, and all eyes went to the dense forest about them, watching uneasily. The going was still relatively smooth. The ground was level as the path wound sharply through the great forest, leading them steadily northward. The light of the morning sun shone in long streamers through cracks in the heavy branches, occasionally cutting across their path and catching their faces as they walked, warming them briefly in the cool air of the forest. Beneath their feet, the fallen leaves and twigs were soaked with a heavy dew, making a cushion that masked the sound of their footsteps and helped to preserve the quiet of the day. All about them, they could hear sounds of life, though they saw only multicolored birds and a few squirrels that scampered eagerly about their treetop domains, sometimes raining the travelers below with torrents of nuts and twigs as they leaped from branch to branch. The trees prevented the members of the company from seeing much of anything, their great girth ranging from 3 to 10 feet in diameter, and their huge roots stretching out from the trunks like mammoth fingers, digging their way relentlessly into the earth of the forest floor. The view from every direction was masked, and the company had to content itself with relying on Hendel's familiarity with the country and the pathfinding knowledge of Menyon Lee to guide them through the maze of vegetation. The first day passed without incident, and they spent the night beneath the giant trees, somewhere north of the Silver River and Cullhaven. Hendel was apparently the only one who knew exactly where they were, though Alanon conversed briefly with the taciturn dwarf concerning their whereabouts and the route they were taking. The company ate its dinner cold, fearing that a fire might attract attention. But the general mood was light, and the conversation was enjoyable. Shay took this opportunity to speak with the two elves. They were cousins of Eventine, chosen to accompany Alanon as representatives of the Elven Kingdom and to aid him in his search for the Sword of Shannara. They were brothers, the elder called Durin, a slim, quiet Westlander who gave the